8:35, first one of the year, and let's let the record show that we have Representative Salmon, Representative Elkins, co-chair, Representative Ledoux, and Representative Thomas present. Today's topic is HB 328. We do not intend to move the bill. And I have to apologize. I said there would be no public testimony. We have three departments to testify, and we figured they'd take a lot of the time, and then the sponsor of the bill make his presentation, and we were trying to get in two fishing groups and then continue the process next week, expecting either probably a CS after today's discussion. So we will take public testimony next week. If we have time today, we'll take some, but because we want to make sure that everybody's happy with the presentation of the bill, we'll let it go. And Paul, you can come up and join us if you want. Is this seat open here too?
Yes.
We're going to run out of seats here. Kurt, you want to come up and join us?
Sure.
Let me drag one more in for the, we'll allow for the senator. Is somebody going to be missing?
I didn't know if Peggy was going to make it or not. The senator could come up.
Do you see the carries?
I know. That's what I'm looking for. Looking for another chair for you, Senator.
This is just fine.
Well, just in case. If we go along and somebody doesn't show, we'll drag you up here. Okay, so today's HB 328. First, we'll hear the administration, who will go over their new proposed regs that they've issued. And at this time, we have Mackay. I don't know who the other people are, so...
But you're right in your left hand with you.
So this time, Mackay, you'll introduce Commissioner Mackay. Welcome to Fishing Game, or Fish from Fishing Game. Yeah. And let introduce the people you brought with you and with departments.
I think they were kind enough to bring me along with
them. Maybe I'll scooch this over.
You want to?
Sure. Representative Thomas and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Kent, and I'm the director of the Division of Water at the Department of Environmental Conservation. Carrie.
Hi, I'm Carrie Howard. I'm the director of the Office of Habitat Management and Permitting at DNR.
And Representative Thomas, Commissioner Fredrickson asked me to particularly extend his regrets at not being able to be here. He would have, except he is on grand jury duty, and the judge didn't see fit. This is a fit excuse to excuse him. So,
okay.
He also expressed his concern about being here and wanting to be here because he was so involved in the development of our new regulations. Thank you for providing us with the opportunity to talk to you this morning about mixing zones. Everyone should have a copy of the packet that we provided. If you don't, you should try to find one. You'll notice that in the upper right-hand corner of these packets, there is a circled number. That's so that I can refer to the various documents as I go through my testimony today. As far as the outline for our presentation today, I will first cover some background on water quality standards and mixing zones from a general perspective. I will talk a bit about our old regulations and our new regulations and their effects, and in particular how we have dealt with mixing zones in fish spawning areas. And then last, I will compare the goals of our new regulations with the goals of House Bill 328. Before I start on my outline, though, I want you to know right away why the department engaged in amendments to our mixing zone regulations and to provide a little bit of context. Our old regulations contained a prohibition on mixing zones and spawning areas that we feel went well beyond what is scientifically necessary in order to protect fish. And probably just as importantly, the old regulations simply weren't fair. They weren't fair to facilities that invested in developing facility infrastructure, who then got a permit from us with a discharge and an authorized mixing zone, and where the fish later moved into that area and it became a spawning area. In those situations, that would have precluded DEC from reauthorizing continuation of that permit in that authorized mixing zone. The mixing zone issues are relevant to you and to the communities that you represent. There are over 400 authorized mixing zones in Alaska. 157 of those are for municipal sewage treatment facilities, like those in the communities that you represent. We have them in Petersburg, Wrangell, Haines, Skagway, Ketchikan, Kodiak, and a lot of the villages that need mixing zones. As far as background, I want to talk a little bit about the water quality standards in general. DEC has to have water quality standards that are designed to protect the multiple uses of Alaska's waters. And those uses include things like drinking water, protection of public health, safety, and welfare, growth and propagation of aquatic life, domestic, commercial, and industrial uses, and recreational uses. So our water quality standards end up being numerical and narrative criteria that are established in regulation that describe how clean water has to be to protect those uses. A mixing zone is an area in a water body where treated wastewater is discharged and allowed to mix with the water body. The water quality standards may be exceeded within that permitted mixing zone, but have to be met at the edge of the mixing zone. And all uses of the overall water body have to be protected. A few mixing zone facts. Mixing zones are not unique to Alaska. All states rely on mixing zones when authorizing wastewater discharge permits. Mixing zones are allowed under the Federal Clean Water Act, and EPA has published guidance on how to establish mixing zones. Mixing zones are not a blanket approval to discharge pollutants into water bodies. Their size and shape are calculated by our engineers using mathematical models and site-specific information, things like the concentration of the pollutants, the water volumes, and the flow rates. Once authorized, permits may require the permittee to monitor not only the concentration of the contaminants that come out the end of the pipe, but also to monitor in the ambient water and at the edge of the mixing zone to make sure that the water quality standards are achieved by the time the water gets to the edge of the mixing zone. And then we don't just go away. DEC has an inspection and monitoring program. We do independent monitoring and take enforcement actions. Mixing zones have been allowed in Alaska for the past 30 years and are only allowed as a part of a permitted wastewater discharge facility that undergoes public review and comment. There are a tremendous number of requirements in order to get a mixing zone, and I want to go through those with you. So if you'll turn to handout number 3 in your packets. It's a very long list. Mine's yellow. Yours is not. In order to authorize a mixing zone, DEC has to first consider the characteristics of the receiving water, the characteristics of the effluent, the cumulative effects of multiple discharges, measures that would mitigate potential adverse effects to aquatic resources, and then any other relevant factors that we think are important to consider when authorizing a discharge. DEC has to make certain findings before we can authorize a mixing zone. We have to ensure that the effluent will be treated using the most effective methods that are technologically and economically feasible, and they have to be consistent with statutory and regulatory treatment requirements. We have to find that the uses of the water body as a whole will be maintained and protected. Again, those uses for things like drinking water or aquatic life. We have to ensure that the overall biological integrity of the water body will not be impaired and that the mixing zone is as small as practicable. We also have to find that the mixing zone will not do certain things. A mixing zone cannot result in a toxic effect in the water column, sediments, or biota outside the boundaries of a mixing zone, cannot create a public health hazard that would preclude or limit existing uses of the water body for water supply or contact recreation, which is things like wading or swimming. A mixing zone cannot preclude or limit established processing activities, commercial, sport, personal use, or subsistence fish and shellfish harvesting. A mixing zone cannot result in the reduction of fish or shellfish population levels. It cannot result in permanent or irreparable displacement of indigenous species. Cannot adversely affect threatened or endangered species. They cannot form a barrier to migratory species or to fish passage. They cannot contain pollutants that bioaccumulate, bioconcentrate, or persist above natural levels. They cannot present an unacceptable risk to human health. They cannot settle to form objectionable deposits or produce floating debris, oil, or scum in concentrations that form nuisances. They cannot result in undesirable or nuisance aquatic life. They cannot produce objectionable color, taste, or odor in aquatic resources that are harvested for human consumption. They cannot cause lethality to any passing organisms. and they cannot exceed acute aquatic life criteria beyond a smaller initial mixing zone right near the outfall. So those are pretty stringent and thorough requirements for mixing zones. So why do we need mixing zones? There are virtually no sewage treatment plants or seafood processors in Alaska that could discharge wastewater to a surface water body that could operate without an authorized mixing zone. If you flip to handout number 4, this is a pie chart. It's simply a representation of the types of facilities that rely upon mixing zones in Alaska. So it is, as I mentioned, sewage treatment plants, seafood processors, placer mines, oil and gas related facilities, large mines, and fertilizer plant. And I'd like to take a moment just to give you an example of what mixing zones look like in the real world. So if you'll turn to handout number 5, it's entitled Examples of Mixing Zones in Alaska Today. There are 3 of them here. The first is a general permit for seafood processing facilities that discharge to marine waters. Their mixing zone is authorized for residue, dissolved gas, oil and grease, pH, color, turbidity, fecal coliform, chlorine, and temperature. And to get a picture of what this looks like in the real world, it's a cylindrical volume of water with a horizontal radius of 100 feet from the diffuser and goes for the full depth of the water body, so from the surface down to the bottom of the ocean. The second example is the Mendenhall Wastewater Treatment Plant here in Juneau that discharges to the Mendenhall River. This mixing zone is authorized for fecal coliform bacteria, dissolved oxygen, pH, metals, nutrients, and whole effluent toxicity. In this case, the width of the mixing zone is 30 meters, and it extends both upstream and downstream of the diffuser for 150 meters. And in this case, that's because the river is tidally influenced, so the water is pushed back upstream, and it runs for the full depth of the river. And then the third example is the Soldotna Sewage Treatment Facility that discharges into the Kenai River. The mixing zone is authorized for similar parameters as the Juneau Sewage Treatment Plant. This mixing zone extends downstream from the diffuser, the end of the pipe, for a distance of 47 meters and has a width of 5 meters. So those are just some examples of what they actually look like. So why do we need these mixing zones? Many types of wastewater could actually be treated with today's technology to meet water quality standards at the end of the pipe and not have to rely upon a mixing zone. Unfortunately, this level of treatment can be so expensive that no businesses could operate, and you and I probably couldn't afford to flush our toilets. Mixing zones are a highly regulated tool that keep treatment costs reasonable while still ensuring protection of human health and the environment. So why are we changing those regulations? The first reason is an administrative reason. DEC is required by the Clean Water Act to review all of our water quality standards every 3 years. We have to seek agency and public input on the standards and which standards should be revised. The proposed changes to the mixing zone regulations in part grew out of that review. The second reason is a much more practical reason. DEC's old regulations contained a prohibition on mixing zones and spawning areas in streams and rivers for anadromous fish and some specifically listed resident fish. That prohibition was added to the regulations in 1995. Multiple options for exceptions to that mixing zone prohibition were considered at that time but not adopted. And in the intervening years, there have been several attempts to consider different types of exceptions to that prohibition. During the past 2 years, there has been substantial public involvement on potential changes to the mixing zone regulations, with 2 lengthy formal public comment periods that extended for 161 days. We tackled these regulations for 3 specific reasons. The first, as I mentioned before, we felt like the prohibition on mixing zones and spawning areas went beyond what is scientifically necessary to protect fish and that there are many protections in place for fish. We also felt that those regulations weren't fair to those, again, who invested in a facility, had a mixing zone authorized, and then later that area became a spawning area. And then finally, the old regulations were not really synchronized with how we do business today. The public perception was that DEC operates independently when permitting discharges and authorizing mixing zones. Yet in practice, DEC has deferred to the Departments of Fish and Game and Natural Resources to identify spawning areas and to utilize their fish protection authorities, and these are now reflected in our new regulations. Let me provide a few specific examples of how the old regulations really were unfair The first example, many of you have heard about this, is the Valdez Sewage Treatment Facility. This is a sewage treatment plant that discharges into a man-made ditch that then runs into the ocean. Since the initial mixing zone was authorized in that ditch, salmon have begun spawning in that ditch. The city of Valdez faced an expensive facility retrofit, either to change their treatment process or to run a discharge pipe out to marine waters with no net benefit to the environment and no net benefit to salmon. In fact, removing this wastewater from the ditch could actually have the effect of reducing salmon spawning. The second example is the Palmer Sewage Treatment Plant that discharges to the Matanuska River. This is a braided river that's constantly changing courses. A mixing zone was authorized in an area that now supports salmon spawning, likely due to natural river course changes and clear water inputs. Palmer was also facing a potential expensive facility retrofit, again, either to change their treatment process or to move their discharge outfall. And then the third example is the Pogo Mine. And here I'm not referring to a mining discharge, per se, but to the domestic wastewater discharge from their man camp. In this situation, the discharge is to the Good Pasture River, and most of the area near the facility is a spawning area. The mine had to pay to conduct a detailed review of the river in order to find a small area where the river runs over bedrock that DNR and Fish and Game determined was not suitable for spawning, and then place their outfall in that specific area of the river. The authorized mixing zone is very small. It extends 5 feet from the outfall. The company in this case had to go to great expense to find this area to discharge a substance, fecal coliform, that could have been discharged anywhere in the river with no adverse effects on fish. And the reason for that is that fecal coliform bacteria is an indicator of a potential human health threat, but it does not have a negative impact on fish. You'll find a copy of our new regulations at handout number one. In response to public comment, we adopted these final regulations this month that make a specific or that make a distinction between the five species of anadromous salmon and other specifically listed fish. So for purposes of discussion, I'll use the term non-salmon for those specifically listed fish, although that term is not entirely correct. It's just easier to say. So our new regulations for salmon retained the prohibition on mixing zones and spawning areas of all fresh waters for salmon. This is exactly the same as the old regulations with one exception, and that is that we have added lakes to the list of waters where the prohibition is in effect. For the other specifically listed fish species, those I'll refer to as non-salmon, again, we retained the prohibition on mixing zones and spawning areas of all fresh waters, again, adding lakes from the old regulations for these listed non-salmon species. The new regulations for non-salmon allow for two potential narrow exceptions to that prohibition. The first is that DEC can authorize a mixing zone in a non-spawning area, but only where all water quality standards for protection of aquatic life are met. If you look at handout number six, sorry to run you through all of these, you'll see the first two green lines across there. These are for the parameters for arsenic and fecal coliform, and I just use them by way of example. In this case, the water quality standards for protection of drinking water and human health are more stringent than they are for protection of aquatic life. So under this exception, DEC could authorize a mixing zone in a non-salmon spawning area so long as all of the water quality standards for protection of aquatic life were met, which means no adverse impacts on fish. The second potential exception would be a situation where DEC could authorize a mixing zone in a non-salmon spawning area where the Department of Fish and Game, or DNR, has approved a mitigation plan following their mitigation requirements that already apply to all activities potentially affecting fish. DEC's new mixing zone regulations also include a provision to address the fairness issue that I spoke about. In cases where a mixing zone was previously authorized in an area where there was not spawning and then salmon or the listed non-salmon species later move into that area and begin to successfully spawn, DEC would be allowed to reauthorize that mixing zone so long as all of the other provisions of the regulations are still being met. This is the provision that will allow the Valdez and Palmer sewage treatment facilities to continue to operate without costly facility reconstruction. HB 328. Both DEC's new regulations and HB 328 share a common goal, and that goal is protection of fish. DEC believes that mixing zones can be authorized in spawning areas under certain circumstances, and that we, along with Fish and Game and DNR biologists, have the scientific know-how to protect those fish. Nevertheless, we heard loud and clear from the public, and we also recognize that salmon are of such great importance to the Alaska economy, and that the perception of clean and healthy fish is so important to that economy that our regulations include special protections for salmon above and beyond what science may tell us we need. So for salmon protection, DEC's regulations and HB 328 take similar approaches by prohibiting mixing zones in salmon spawning areas. For the non-salmon fish, our regulations in HB 328 take a little bit differing approach to protect those fish. HB 328 proposes to prohibit mixing zones in non-salmon spawning areas, whereas DEC regulations rely on sound science and existing DNR and fish and game protection policies to protect those species. We also agree that the need to have flexibility in the laws to address situations where spawning begins in previously authorized mixing zones. And there's one other difference in the approaches between HB 328 and DEC's regulations. HB 328 would allow a mixing zone in a spawning area only in situations where there is a new man-made water body and fish begin to spawn there. This flexibility would resolve the problem for the Valdez sewage treatment facility, but would not address the Palmer sewage treatment plant situation where that mixing zone has been authorized in a natural water body that later became a spawning area. DEC's regulations would resolve both the Palmer, the Valdez situation and the Palmer type situations. So we are available for discussion and questions. Did you? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I might.
If I might, I had told him, I said I'd mainly answer questions, but felt compelled to add just a few things. First off, and this is Mackay Campbell, Commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I want to make clear that I'm here today and have been involved throughout this process as an advocate for fish and fishermen and all those who use fish. And the process itself, since I've become involved, I have to say, has been one of the most internally constructive process with DEC and DNR and Fish and Game working together for common goals that I've been involved with. I've been in and out of natural resource and issues both inside and outside of government for for pushing 30 years here in Alaska. And I was extraordinarily impressed in the way the three departments were able to work together. One of the key questions we faced was the level of protection. As an advocate for the fish, I absolutely want to make sure that fish are protected, that they are protected in the reality, and because marketing of fish is certainly an issue for it that we're concerned about, in the perception of that as well. I strongly wound up believing that where we are now, I was not particularly happy with the regs the way they very first started out. I had concerns. But where we are now, I'm very pleased, and I do feel they offer fish all the level of protection that is needed, while not needlessly adding layers of regulation that impinge on other uses and stuff. I can best protect fish and best protect the environment when I can make sure I can show how the regulations we have that do that are real and needed. When they go beyond that level, then I have a very difficult time defending them. I actually wanted to also mention there are several things in our regulations that one of which has been picked up in the bill and one of which is not, that I think are actually substantial improvements on the protection of fish. One is that you have picked up in the bill, and I really appreciate this, and I want to emphasize I strongly, strongly appreciate the intentions behind the bill. I mean, we're sharing the same concerns and intentions. The concern, the one thing that has been picked up in the new regulations that never did exist in the old regulations was the addition of protection of spawning areas in lakes. As you're aware, many salmon, but particularly sockeye, are heavily dependent on lake spawning. In the old regulations, up until that were in effect, it assuming protected streams, rivers, or other flowing fresh water. And so we've added lakes, and you all have picked that up in your bill, and I think that's a major improvement. The next improvement goes to what I see is perhaps some confusion about what past practices have always been. There's a document handed out here. Unfortunately, it's not
identified or signed by who did it, but it evidences some major confusion about how spawning areas are identified. And what the document says is that under the bill and in the old regs, that spawning areas were always protected, anytime, always, no matter what was happening there. I guess what I want to make plain is that I think as long as the state has been regulating activities in spawning areas, which goes back at least 30 years, I'm pretty sure of, this is things like driving bulldozers through spawning areas or other things like that. The identification of what is a spawning area has always been done both spatially and temporally. And what I mean by that is to determine where a spawning area is or what is a spawning area, the identification has always been both what part of the creek does the spawning occur in, when are spawning fish, eggs, or alevins present, and also, excuse me, where that occurs and when that occurs. And when the state began to, in 1995, when this issue first came up, connected with mixing zones and spawning areas, that same identification has continued throughout. So continuously for probably the last three decades, the identification of what is and is not a spawning area depends on not only where it is, but when the appropriate activity is happening. That is absolutely unchanged under our regulations. It is unchanged from the past regulations, and there's nothing in the bill that changes that. and actually, I had, when we were in Representative Ledoux's office yesterday, her staff, Kim, right here somewhere, asked the analogy. Someone said, well, someone told me it was like a basketball court when you're playing basketball, you know, only when the basketball players are on it. I said, you know, that's almost exactly it. I play old guys basketball Sunday afternoons. A bunch of us should know better, get together and play. And often when we get there, Mount Jumbo Gym is heavily utilized. A lot of times there's kids' birthday parties that are going on, and they're finishing up at 3 o'clock, and then we go on and we play for a couple hours. And a lot of times when we finish, there are women's volleyball teams wanting to come on. But the key there is to, A, make sure we have the court when we need it, and B, make sure there's nothing that happened to that court that interferes with the use. It has always been past practice, but never in regulation, to ensure that any discharges do not adversely affect the spawning areas. In this set of regulations, for the first time, there is a very specific measure which says that nothing in a mixing zone, no discharge, whether it's in an area that will later be used for spawning or not, can adversely affect the future capability of that area to be used for spawning. I think some folks have seen that and kind of gotten confused about or not understood what past practice is and said, oh, this is a big loophole in the bill. Actually, for me, this is a major improvement. It puts into regulation the requirement that you can't do anything in the water body that's going to adversely affect the capability of a spawning area. The last thing that I would just urge you all to consider, and this is a political decision for you, and you'll certainly come to your own conclusions about it, but if after the end of these hearings you feel the administration has done a responsible job in protecting fish, has done a responsible job in crafting regulations that not only protect fish but also allow for other uses where appropriate, where they wouldn't interfere on the fish, then I would urge you at least to consider the option of declaring victory. And I say this because one of the questions we've received is, well, okay, what if you convince us your regs are great? Wouldn't it be better if we put them all in statute? And the thing that I'm a little bit concerned about, having been through a number of these battles in the past, is if that all happens, I have some concern about what's appropriate for regulation versus statute. But I also have concern that if this goes through and doesn't make it and doesn't pass, there's going to be tremendous pressure on Commissioner Fredrickson to say, look, the legislature has spoken. They do not support the level of protection you've provided. They do not support this. We need you to liberalize these. As an advocate of fish, I'm very pleased with these regulations. I'm pleased about how we got there. The public process was often messy, but it has worked, and I appreciate you all's help with that.
Just want to make a comment about the old timers playing basketball.
We need you back out there.
Yeah, if I may. I played briefly and I always went from point A to point B, and they never fully utilized the court like we did when we were 15 to 35.
Right.
So there is a, you know, a chance you could use it.
Yes.
I know how you play. I
mean, yeah.
Been there. Okay, questions? Before we go on, I want the record to show that Representative Capizzo has been here for the last half hour. So, okay, Representative Salmon.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a question for the person that just last spoke. Is that, are you supporting this bill or are you supporting the old type of regulations?
Sir, what I am supporting is the new regulations that the Department of Environmental Conservation has made public here last week. I am suggesting that while I greatly appreciate and agree with the intention of the bill, that this matter is best and most fully addressed in regulation, and that there are at least some considerable political risks to the fish by pursuing it. But that's your decision. I wouldn't presume to make that.
Representative Capsmer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I have a couple questions. One of them is your staff, you know, in the last 12 years, we've cut a lot of positions at Fish and Game and other departments, and we've seen a lot less money go into Fish and Game and then a lot less federal matching funds go in. And my concern is regarding the staffing that you have available to go and actually look at these operations and then do follow-up. Can you tell me, can you give examples of how you've done follow-up in the past and if you really think that you are well enough staffed to go through and do this just by regulation?
Sure. If I might, and I'm going to defer, after a brief clarification, defer part of this to DNR. As you were aware, several years ago, the Division of Habitat Protection was transferred to the Department of Natural Resources. Frankly, and there's no particular secret about this, I was not a fan of that move. I felt there were some issues there. I felt there were management issues that could be resolved without shifting them. But it happened, and I have to say that it is working substantially better than I expected it to work. In fact, I think it's working very well. A lot of the folks who used to be Fish and Game employees are over at DNR. I believe we have Al Lott and Mac Menard on the line. Mac McLean, who are longtime, very, very talented, dedicated Fish and Game employees, who are now longtime dedicated DNR employees, and they have been doing a good job. We do retain some habitat capability, and we take a very keen interest and kind of watch closely what DNR does, and we've been pleased with it. But I should probably defer to Carrie for examples.
As for Fish and Game, Mr. Chairman, you didn't really answer that question. I mean, I know that habitat was put under Fish and Game, but my question is, do you have the staffing to go out and patrol these?
We do not have the staffing to go out and patrol these issues. What we do is we certainly have the staff to pay attention to issues that seem to be of particular concern to us, but it is our area of interest, but not our jurisdiction, to go out and, you know, case by case check everyone. But those that we think have potential concern, we watch them very closely. We stay in close cooperation, work in close cooperation with DNR. As you said, you were correct. Our budget has taken, over the last decade, some major hits. I'm very pleased in the governor's proposed budget. We're reversing that substantially this year. But
Representative Capsner, through the chair. I'm, again, Carrie Howard with the Office of Habitat Management and Permitting. As Commissioner Campbell mentioned, back in 2003, the division was moved to DNR. Coupled with that move, we did sustain an 18% cut in staff and an 11% cut in budget. But quite frankly, and that was based on the percentage of staff that were doing the equivalent tasks that moved over to DNR. But through all of your support last year, I'm pleased to say that we were able to gain additional support in general fund to replace some of the funds that we have lost. So probably for the Habitat is in the best position we've been in years in terms of having stable funding and stable staff. And I say this with a little bit of historical experience because I worked for the division back in the early 80s as well. But what's key about this, too, we're a small office. I have 37 staffs statewide, and honestly, most of the mixing zones, you'll notice throughout the regulations, say that either DNR or Fish and Game will be involved in evaluating the mixing zone and effects on salmon. But I can assure you that my 37 staff are multiplied tenfold because for every mixing zone that's reviewed, we'll be working with the professionals at Fish and Game. And Mackay and I both believe strongly in maintaining the relationship between the biologists that are there and the biologists at DNR. Quite frankly, it's a synergistic relationship, and we both work hard to continue that, as do all my staff. So we actually have struck a memorandum of understanding. This was signed a couple of years ago that says for pretty much anything other than routine projects, if there is an issue that's going to be of interest to the biologists at Fish and Game, we seek their input. And I can guarantee you for mixing zone, any mixing zone proposal that's bigger than a bread box, we're definitely going to be working with the biologists. And key to this is we do have the staff to do the review up front. We don't have biologists. It's a huge state to run out and look at every single project we permit. My staff permit close to 2,500 actions a year, and that's obviously an array of activities. But we do have the staff who review these up front, and many of them are fairly routine, and many of them we have over years of experience developed standard stipulations, so we know the protections that are needed to mitigate impacts. For the projects that really do push the envelope a bit and monitoring is needed, we have been able to find a way to either have the monitoring done by the companies who are doing the work, who then send us the results, or we have staff participating in it. So that is simply not a concern for me or my commissioner or for Fish and Game.
I just have a couple more questions.
Mary?
Yeah, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before you change the regulations, so I guess that would be last year, how many applicants were there for mixing zones?
I don't have an exact number for you, but what I can tell you is that the wastewater discharge permits are generally renewed every 5 years. So we're looking at one-fifth of the facilities having a permit renewal, existing facilities having a permit renewal in any given year. And then, of course, there are always some new projects each year.
Okay. Out of those that, just to follow up, out of the people, the applicants who did apply, how many were accepted and how many were denied? What was the change in acceptance of applications between the 2 years regulations?
Perhaps I could interject just to be sure. The old regulations, which everyone was still so fond of, were in effect right up until, or still are.
Still in effect.
So, yeah.
Okay, so there hasn't been a change.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Okay, how can you project into the future what you think that change might be? The percentage that would be accepted under the new regulations, if that, how that would change?
Let me hazard a wild non-numeric guess.
Okay.
Of right now in Alaska, there are 439 active mixing zones. There are, and this is on the handout number four, the pie chart that you all have. Of these, 157 of them are municipal wastewater treatment systems, 204 are seafood processors, 59 are placer miners, 15 are oil and gas related facilities, 3 are large mines, and 1 is a fertilizer plant. I am just guessing, but under the regulation, it will certainly allow several municipal wastewater facilities, which we've identified and stuff, to proceed, and not with new mixing zones, but where otherwise the Department of DEC would have had to turn down their license renewal, if these regs were adopted, they will be able to go ahead and renew them. And there may be some small increase in placer miners, is I'm guessing, and I'm guessing. And the reason I say that is, in particular, there are sometimes issues in interior streams where basically grayling or very small dollies are the fish issues, and this may allow, if they can make the proper case, but frankly, it's going to be very difficult for a small placer miner to go through the full mitigation sequence that would be necessary to do that. So I don't see big increases happening. That's my guess.
But potentially it could be one operation that has devastating effects. I mean, that, no, you don't think so?
No. No, it could not. And this is why I say, speaking for the fish, I feel very comfortable about this. Not only is there the prohibition against mixing zones and salmon spawning areas with the one very narrow, what I'll call the Valdez ditch exemption, there are, for high-value resident fish, there is a general prohibition with exceptions, and those exceptions require a very strong mitigation, a hierarchical mitigation sequence. And that hierarchical mitigation sequence is exactly the same hierarchical mitigation sequence that has been used for fish and game, again, for decades, to regulate any other activity. If somebody wanted to come and say, I really, really need to get this bulldozer across the creek, and the only place I can physically do it is through this spawning area, it's the same mitigation sequence we would look at there. There's also great protection in other parts of the regulations, and I think this was the original push on some of the regulations in regulating all the different components that can be in the discharge, all the effects. I feel, again, I wouldn't be sitting up here if I didn't feel safe about protection of the fish for this.
Before we lose all our, run out of time, we need to hear the sponsor coming up too. So any last questions?
Yep. If I could just
take you from your time, so
yes, okay. And I just wanted to find out, because on four it's mixing zone authorized in fresh and marine waters, and of course we're only talking about fresh waters here. How many mixing zones, do we have in the fresh waters? And I guess just following that up, I want to know, in those freshwater streams, how many of those mixing zones require continuous monitoring? And how many DEC inspector visits have you had to those freshwater mixing zones in the last year?
Thank you, Representative. I don't have exact numbers here with me today. What I can tell you about mixing zones in freshwater versus marine waters, many of the municipal sewage treatment plants are to marine waters, but not all of them. We can provide those numbers for you at a later time. The seafood processors, these are almost all marine discharges. There are a few to freshwater. The placer mines are all to freshwater. Oil and gas related facilities, I'd have to check on that for you. I believe they're all marine. The three large mines, those are to freshwater. And then the fertilizer plant, I believe, is a marine water discharge.
And have you had required under those freshwater permits continuous monitoring, and how many visits have you had by DEC inspectors per year?
Thank you, Representative. Through the chair, the monitoring requirements vary from permit to permit based on the potential risk to the environment. So they are different for many of the permits. And in terms of inspections, we share a permitting responsibility with the Environmental Protection Agency. So they conduct inspections on permitted facilities in addition to DEC. So I can't provide you an exact number today, but I'd be happy to provide that information.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner and other departments. This time we'll call Representative Seaton and present his bill.
morning. Thanks
morning.
For the opportunity to present the bill to the committee. This bill is pretty simple. We have a blanket prohibition of mixing zones for pollution mixing zone in spawning areas of the state currently that are currently enforced. We've got some new ones that are coming out. The differences in the new regulations is it separates a commercial salmon species from the resident sport and resident subsistence fisheries, which will not be covered by the new regulations, the new prohibitions. The bill basically, as if you take a look, it just says that we will not have pollution spawning areas, mixing zones in spawning areas, and that is to protect the vitality of all the fish species that we have in Alaska. It's what we're known for, especially if important as the commercial people have talked to you about, and I'm sure you've got a large packet of information on those. And then we have the other species that are very important to interior populations as well as the sport industry that's here. The different approach that we took in this was looking at for an exception was for a artificially constructed channel or acetylene pond. If a company comes in and builds acetylene pond and it's later invaded by fish, what we do is we just say that that will not be reclassified as a spawning area, so the mixing zone would continue. It wouldn't you wouldn't have to have a new permit. You wouldn't have to have any exceptions at all. It would just be that if you artificially construct a ditch, as was done in Valdez, and then it's later invaded by pink salmon, it's not going to be reclassified as a spawning area. The mixing zone permit that you have stays in place. There are some other changes that appears in the regulations, and we just are running out of time here, but for the first time we see a temporal distribution, and if we have time, we can get back and maybe get an answer to that question, because I don't think that there's ever been a mixing zone that's been allowed on a temporal basis in these kinds of areas. So this is where what the whole purpose of the bill was. We've been throughout 2 years trying to work with the administration. I really appreciate that they have changed their attitude on salmon spawning areas. I think it's up to the committee to look and see whether they want to make sure that those protections are for our interior species, subsistence and sport fish, as well as the commercial salmon species. But I am pleased. I would like to get a clarification on the temporalness and whether they would issue within these spawning areas, if they would classify salmon spawning areas as temporally. That could be a real problem, because if a company is required under the new regulations to provide the data on the mixing zone and they look at it in midwinter and say there is no spawning in this area, salmon spawning in this area, and temporarily they are allowed to have a permit, then that permit could be extended and re-permitted forever under the regulations. Hopefully that's not a problem, and within regulations or within statutory definition we can make sure that doesn't happen. You know, I am also here, and the other co-sponsors, prime co-sponsors of this bill, have the intention of making sure that Alaskan waters and our fish species are vibrant and stay healthy, and that's the intent of the bill. And like I say, the regulations that we've had have served us well. I was in a meeting with the governor and with oil companies when they came in and said that they did not want or need these changes to the mixing zones for spawning areas, that they worked with them fine. Most of the mines around the area are working fine with them. The New Pebble Mine have said that they do not want or need a mixing zone, do not intend to employ it. I've only talked to one mine that said that they did need a mixing zone, and I think that could be problematic. One of the things that you've seen in the, from the DEC is that there's placer mines. Please remember that there is a whole nother section of regulations which are site-specific criteria, and for suspended solids, those can, which is generally the placer mine situation, those regulations, whatever the water quality and the suspended solids that are in the stream, become the water quality standards. So you probably heard this horror story of a placer miner out there, and he has to put drinking water back in when he's taking silty water out of a stream. And if that's the case, it is that regulators haven't directed the applicant to the appropriate part of the regulations, because the silt content of the water becomes the water quality standards they should deal with. And also, under site-specific criteria, those can be accelerated. We had 500 parts per million on Red Dog, and just recently, DEC went through the site-specific criteria and raised that to 1,500 parts per million. So for suspended solids, that's taken care of in a different part of the regulations, and I would just have everybody remember that we are dealing right now with only one thing, and that is freshwater and only spawning areas, which currently there are no mixing zones in. So this would allow spawning areas other than salmon, unless this temporal exception has some problem for us, would allow those mixing zones to be applied for in resident spawning fish. Thank you.
Questions from the committee?
Chairman, maybe I could ask the sponsor a question.
Yes, Representative.
Dayton through the chair. Do you have any on-record opposition to your bill at this point?
We have one document that was delivered last night from the Miners Association that was a general, and I believe that should all be in your packet.
It probably is. I thumbed through it, but...
Right. Well, it was just delivered.
What were their concerns?
Their concerns is they just wanted to be able to apply for mixing zones in spawning areas in... you know, that's all their letter says, is that they would like to have the ability to apply for mixing zones. I might further comment that the one mine that has contacted me, I've had teleconference with them, was Donlin Creek, that had a problem with it. They said that they wanted to mix in zones. They did say that they are going to be doing a cyanide leach. Now, this is not a heap where you spray cyanide outside and it runs off and stuff. It's going to be done in a building. But they were going to be using chemicals to denature the cyanide. They didn't think they'd need a mixing zone for the cyanide, but they indicated they might need a mixing zone for the other chemicals. I have no idea what chemicals those are. They also indicated they might need a mixing zone for gypsum. Now, gypsum would be a suspended solid, so I think the site-specific criteria would do that. So I'm not, we haven't been appraised of what pollutants they would need the mixing zone for. But they're the only the only specific example from a mine that have not been able to work within the site-specific exemptions that I've been contacted about.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just have one follow-up. The bill, as it's written now, does allow for, under certain conditions, exemptions, or does it totally preclude any discharge into a mixing zones into salmon spawning streams?
The bill, as it's written now, is exactly the way the current regs are, and that is that in spawning areas for salmon and for other listed resident fish, you know, those subsistence and commercial species that are listed on that page, you would not have a mixing zone in the spawning area.
Period.
With the and the exemption that we've built in here is if you dig a ditch for discharge, or if you dig a settling pond, you wouldn't have to worry about that ever being reclassified as a mixing zone, I mean as a spawning area, such as that was Valdez's problem. It was just that, you know, how many million pink salmon did you have from the hatchery, and they wander everywhere, and they...
They're all looking for a place to go.
They're looking for a place to go, and this would mean that, that where they went, if it was an artificially constructed channel, wouldn't be reclassified.
Yeah.
Representative Ledoux?
Commissioner Campbell referred to a problem with the Palmer treatment facility, I think, in which wasn't a spawning area before, but it's now become a spawning area. What's happening with that facility right now under the existing regulations?
My understanding is both it and Soldotna, well, Soldotna has not been identified as a spawning area, but the same kind of potential is there. And I would like to work with the committee, and I think that what we need to do is for municipal wastewater, build in some kind of an exemption so we don't have the same problem, even though it's a natural system. When new facilities are built, hopefully they would come up to the water quality standards, which we would all like to have in our, in all of our discharges anyway. But for existing facilities, I would like to work with the committee, and you know, we have been working on that, and we haven't come up with the exact language, but that would be an amendment that I would like to see.
So you envision that that's something that can be done within the bill?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Salmon?
Yes, I have one question. Is that we're talking about one type of fish, which is salmon, different types of salmon, and we're talking about spawning areas. And if you look at, like, Yukon River or Kuskokwim or, you know, one of the longer rivers, not all areas are spawning ground. So is dumping under this new bill, is dumping allowed in the river just because it's not spawning ground?
To the chair, Representative Salmon, the current regulations allow for mixing zones to be applied for in non-spawning areas. We've got about... we've got the list we could pass out to you of the number of anadromous catalogs. There's like 14,000 streams in the state, of which about 5,000 are that are anadromous, have anadromous fish, of which about 5,000 or almost 6,000 have spawning in them. So the other streams that are not cataloged as spawning, you can have a mixing zone in those presently, yes. And this bill does not go any further than the existing regulations in saying anything about those passage areas. What this does is just institute the current state policy of saying we're not going to have mixing zones in spawning areas.
Representative Elkins.
I'm just sitting through the chair. Wouldn't we be better off if we required the municipalities, because there's to a time where they'd have to come into compliance rather than just grant them waivers? It wouldn't be popular, I understand that.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Elkins, you know, I think that water quality standards are very important for, you know, all of our streams. That'd be a decision for the legislature. I mean, it would be one way to look at it. I think that that's a funding cycle problem and others as well, but I haven't proposed that.
I wish I'd think about it.
Any other questions? I have a couple, Representative Seaton. One is, and I ask your staff, what if you have a deadlock, or lakes, dead lakes, and now with this potential new hatchery being built in the Fairbanks area, they start dumping fish and introducing fish into dead lakes. How are we going to handle, and even in the past, I'm sure there's a lot of lakes that, because we've had hatcheries all over Alaska, we've introduced fish into a system. What do you do where the fish have been introduced into a lake where either a person wanted a mixing zone permit there, or, you know, and it's not, it could be called natural, but it's not.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're talking about a lake that doesn't have a mixing zone on it currently, and then had a population introduced that then became a self-sustaining population in a lake?
Or not. They keep adding every year, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you kept adding every year, it wouldn't be a spawning situation. This bill would have no effect. If what you did was have a natural lake that you introduced a spawning, a population that was self-sustaining in, then that would have a spawning area as long as it's one of the species that's listed on here. Now, if it's another species of fish that's not on the list, it wouldn't apply anyway. I mean, sticklebacks. I mean, we have sticklebacks around, and they can be spawning wherever. And this bill specifically has the list of fish that are important for subsistence, for sport, and for commercial uses.
Okay, thank you. Representative Capsner requested that, you have a question of the sponsor?
No, not of the bill sponsor, but of the former people testifying.
Any other questions of the sponsor? Thank you, Representative Seaton. You can join us here again, and Representative Capsner is requesting the administration come back. Did the other two? Oh, there.
We'll see how much help we need.
Representative Capsner, and then identify yourself each time you talk so that a recorder can tell who's there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had some questions about some of the language that's in the regulations. It's, there aren't clear definitions, and there's three different ones. One is technologically and economically feasible. I mean, I guess an argument could be made that, anything is not economically feasible. Another one is significantly adverse levels. That seems very vague. And then the last one is spatially and temporally in reference to spawning areas. So,
if I could ask Lynn to address the first two, and then maybe I could take a crack at the third.
And I know you did touch on it briefly.
My apologies, through the chair.
Okay, again, this is Lynn Kent with Department of Environmental Conservation. The first question had to do with the language under, I'm trying to find it here, 240C1, that says that an effluent or substance will be treated to remove, reduce, and disperse pollutants using methods found by the department to be the most effective, that are technologically and economically feasible, and at a minimum consistent with statutory and regulatory requirements. And then we go on to list those statutory requirements that are specifically referenced here. There are minimum treatment requirements that are established in both federal and state regulation that a facility has to meet. And this statement is designed to say that you've got to meet those at a floor, those treatment requirements. What this does is allow us to require treatment that may go above and beyond those minimum treatment standards, so long as they're technologically doable and economically doable.
How do you decide if they are technically, Mr. Chairman, or economically feasible?
In part, it depends upon the type of discharge and the types of treatment technologies that have been employed elsewhere. So there are things you can do in a laboratory to remove a contaminant from water that simply couldn't be affordable for any facility or for a community sewage treatment facility. We have the technological capability to treat sewage to drinking water levels, but I don't think you or I want to pay the amount it would take to flush your toilet each time to achieve that standard.
Okay. Let's see. The second one was significantly adverse levels.
Yes, through the chair. Do you have the reference for that so I can find it quickly here?
It was used to describe the acceptable concentration of pollutants. It says pollutions may exist, but not in significantly adverse levels.
Could you perhaps get a page or a letter reference?
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me. It was just from notes from yesterday.
Yeah, I think I would have these memorized.
It's D1.
Okay,
Okay, this, what this provision, excuse me, through the chair, what this provision says is that there needs to be a demonstration that the discharge pollutants will not bioaccumulate, bioconcentrate, or persist above natural levels in sediments, water, or biota to significantly adverse levels based upon consideration of bioaccumulation and bioconcentration factors, toxicity, and exposure. Elsewhere in DEC regulations and under D2, you will see a reference to those regulations, 18 AEC 70025. DEC has set a risk-based level for human health, and this regulation is referring to that particular risk-based level such that pollutants cannot exceed that risk level for human health.
And if I could, I put the term both spatially and temporally is in subsection J, excuse me, through the chair. It's been a while since I've been here. For purposes of this section, the department will defer to the Department of Natural Resources, Office of Habitat Management and Permitting, or the Department of Fish and Game to determine spawning areas both spatially and temporally. And the reason those words were added is we wanted to be very clear with the public about what has been, again, as I say, for probably the last three decades that I'm sure of, and is now, and under these regulations, and under the bill as it is now drafted, would continue to be the process of determining a spawning area. That certainly could be changed in either regulation or statute if you so wished. But it has always been, for instance, I believe almost every placer miner who has a permit in the state, and we went through all the permits, all these mixing zone permits, one by one by one, operates under timing restrictions often to avoid spawning areas primarily for grayling. Generally, the spawning cycle where spawning fish, eggs, or alevin of salmon are present, that period of time is such an extended period that it's not really going to be very practical for a company to have or to have a discharge or a mixing zone in the interim when they're not there. But for grayling, they have a short spawning cycle, about a month and a half, and almost all, maybe all, we had a list, placer miners right now operate under a thing where they don't do any discharge during the time, that spawning time for grayling, but they do discharge in exactly the same waters the rest of the year. And here we just felt for public clarity, we wanted to be very plain in regulation, put down, not play any tricks or, we didn't tell you what has been current and practice again for mixing zones since 95 when this first became, and for regulation of any other activity of spawning areas, driving a bulldozer, et cetera, across a creek, anything, for probably the last three decades. And so it says it's when spawning fish, eggs, or alevin are present, then the area is considered a spawning area. And again, that's the areas would be determined by either OHMP or Fish and Game, and we are writing those, again, to formalize those into our existing MOU.
Representative Seat.
Thank you, and I appreciate that clarification. Can you get to us the language, because the definition of spawning from an administrative code isn't that extensive. So the spawning is limited to the time the fish are depositing eggs and all. Yeah. And also, can you get to us the clarification that temporarily mixing zones in salmon spawning areas would not then be issued for the other times of the year?
Yeah. excuse me. We will get to you in writing clarification of each of those items, and if it would be helpful, we could give you a rather lengthy list of examples of past practice in this administration, in the Knowles administration, in the Hickel administration,
of permits issued based on this temporal nature of spawning as well.
And through the chair, yeah,
through the chair.
I understand the other permits that are issued based on timing, driving a bulldozer through a creek or, you know, doing some logging practices, which are a little different than a continuous mixing zone for a flutant in that area. So if you could provide those examples, we'd appreciate it.
We will definitely do it. We didn't have this prohibition on mixing zones until 95, so we don't have any examples before 95 because there wasn't a prohibition. But after 95, we'll give you mixing zone examples plus other examples stretching back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any more questions of the panel? Well, thanks for coming back again. We do have time to take some testimony. I think we'll try to take them offline since the people have taken time to come in, so we'll try to limit your comments to 3 minutes or less. And we'll go into Kodiak first to Sean Dockerman. Are you there? Are you there, Sean? You're wasting your 3 minutes. We'll go on to Rebecca Robbins from, looks like, YR Drainage Fish Association. Are you on? About Soldatna, Richard Hound?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you got 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. My concern about
name an association, please.
Oh, sorry. My name is Richard Hahn. I live in Soldatna, Alaska. My concern, especially about the so-called temporal description in the regulations, talks about mixing zones for a short time. And any spawning stream I know about, the eggs are in residence for most of the fish spawn in summer and fall. The eggs are in residence the entire winter, and the young are in residence in the spawning areas the rest of the year, along with migration toward the sea. So to have a restriction temporally simply doesn't make any sense to me. Secondly, I think spawning streams and lakes are a continuum. In essence, they're just one gigantic hatchery. And no self-respecting private hatchery would allow any kind of pollution, dilution of its water. I think that it's very interesting that the mining industry spokesman, Steve Burrell, spoke of strong support for relaxation of the mixing zones. However, when Representative Seaton met with the governor, the oil and gas companies, the New Pebble Mine, and the placer mining people all said they didn't need mixing zones as far as changes were concerned. Yet, when I asked DEC over and over again in writing why they had to make these changes, every argument I got didn't make any sense to me. So I'm truly wondering why these zones can't be better described in statute, because that way, if we need enforcement of the statute, the courts can be involved rather than just some administrative voice from one of the agencies. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none. Rebecca, are you still there? Rebecca Robbins?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, state your name and affiliation, and within 3 minutes or so.
Okay. My name is Becca Robbins. I'm policy coordinator for the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, which we refer to as YRDFA, and we represent subsistence and commercial fishers on the Yukon River. We oppose DEC's proposed mixing zone regulations in both 2004 and 2005, and we don't feel that the new regulations provide adequate protection to either salmon or non-salmon species, and we support HB 328 to protect fish from mixing zone pollution. Our concerns basically stem from the threat mixing zones pose to anadromous and freshwater fish populations. As many of you know, salmon plays a real important cultural and economic role for those who live on the Yukon River. For many of our residents, the commercial salmon harvest provides really the only means of income in the remote villages of the Yukon River. And salmon and other freshwater fish, including grayling, whitefish, and sheafish, provide a primary source of food for residents along the Yukon River, which includes food for dogs utilized in subsistence activities. Mixing zones, by allowing levels of pollution otherwise prohibited under water quality standards, pose a threat to anadromous and freshwater fish and the Yukon River fishers who depend on these fish for income and subsistence. Our concerns also stem from the threat posed by mixing zones to our commercial salmon markets. You've heard a lot about the reputation for clean water, which our markets kind of depend on, and allowing mixing zones in salmon spawning areas, even when salmon are not spawning, could severely harm this image and counter the efforts that we and our fishers have put in to marketing our products. While the regulations as adopted maintain some degree of protection for salmon, we feel they leave a lot to be desired. They give DEC far too much discretion in identifying salmon spawning areas. They give DEC the ability to defer to Department of Natural Resources biologists' opinions and ignore the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's determinations. We feel they continue to place far too much of their responsibility for showing that a mixing zone will not have adverse effects for fish in the hands of the permit applicant. And finally, one of our big concerns is that the proposed regulations really offer far too little protection for non-salmon species. And these are species which many Yukon River subsistence fishers rely on before and after the salmon are running and in years of low salmon returns for subsistence for themselves and their sled dogs. And for these species, under the new regulations, DEC can authorize a mixing zone in a spawning area if the applicant simply submits a mitigation plan. We're particularly concerned about the potential impacts of mixing zones for placer mines on grayling, who are easily affected by mining effluent. HB 328 would once again prohibit mixing zones and spawning areas for salmon and non-salmon species, and we support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. John Toppenberg in Anchorage, are you there?
Yes, good morning. Thank you, ladies, gentlemen. My name is John Toppenberg of Saldana. I'm also director of Alaska Wildlife Alliance, who has 3,000 members. I'm going to try to address things in a that would not necessarily be addressed otherwise, just a couple of points. Regarding current regs, one of the statements was they cannot represent an unacceptable risk to human health. My question is, what is an acceptable risk to human health? And I realize there's a definition for that. But my further question is, will that threshold change with new biomedical discoveries? Should such a change become necessary, will those experiencing subsequent health consequences have civil recourse? And would not fisheries be subject to similar potential problems? I also am concerned that McKee Campbell states that they do not have the staffing necessary. This causes me concern about potential abuses and the possibility that they would occur. Also, we have learned from the recent decision of Judge Gleason that there is a potential for regulatory error or abuse. In my opinion, this would be less likely to occur if standards were articulated in statutes rather than a regulation. To me, there are simply significant loopholes to this situation we're in with regulations, and they need to be closed by statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? None. Thank you again. All right, George Matz from...
Thank you very much. My name is George Matz. I'm representing the Cook Inlet Alliance here in Homer. And I'd like to read to you a letter we submitted to Representative Seaton on this HB 328. The Cook Inlet Alliance wants to thank you for your attention to constituent concerns regarding mixing zone regulations and for introducing HB 328 as a practical, no-nonsense solution to this dilemma. Even though the Department of Environmental Conservation adopted modified mixing zone regulations earlier this week, we think HB 328 is still needed for two compelling reasons. One, to eliminate ambiguity and possible loopholes that still exist with DEC's adopted regulations. And two, to protect spawning areas for all species of anadromous fish as well as resident fish. As you well know, there have been a few instances where a wastewater discharge permit was issued that allowed a mixing zone and afterwards salmon started spawning in the zone. While these situations obviously need attention, regulations proposed twice by DEC to correct the problem were essentially throwing the baby out with the bath. The regulations that DEC adopted on January 12th are less objectionable with respect only to salmon, but still allow open-ended questions that could turn into loopholes. This lack of certainty gives the impression that a wastewater discharge permit is a negotiated process, not one to meet a specified standard of water quality. The four problems we see are, one, who defines the spawning area? The adopted regulations say that DEC will defer to the Department of Natural Resources or the Department of Fish and Game. These two departments have different missions and often different perspectives on resource development conservation issues, which is the way it should be. Putting OR in the regulations creates a situation where DEC could arbitrarily decide which to pick, thereby introducing bias to the permit process. Two, spawning areas need year-round protection. Let's see, this has been covered, so I'll skip to the number three here. DEC's regulations do not describe what happens when a wastewater discharge permit is requested for a body of water that is not in the catalog of waters important for spawning, rearing, or migration of anadromous fish. As described on Fish and Game's website, the catalog and atlas are important because they specify which streams, rivers, lakes, and are important to anadromous fish species and therefore afforded protection under AS 41.14.870. Water bodies that are not specified within the catalog and atlas are not afforded that protection. This is a quote. Based upon thorough surveys of a few drainages, it's believed that specified water bodies represent less than 50% of the streams, rivers, and lakes actually used by anadromous species. While large projects that need an environmental impact statement may provide the information if it did not previously exist, our concern is more about the cumulative impacts of the many smaller projects that need wastewater discharge permits but don't have the means or requirements to undertake expensive... my time up? Or?
Just wrap up, please.
Okay. Well, I'll skip to the fourth point. DEC's adopted regulations are unnecessarily convoluted. And in Section F says, well, I guess I won't read this. I'll wrap up there. I submitted to Senator Representative Seaton, so maybe you have copies of this letter.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Our bells are ringing, but we have two people left online, so we'll try to get them. Norma Van Vachter, are you still off that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
My name is Norman Van Vachter, and I guess I'll be real brief here. For one, I'd just like to echo, I think her name was Rebecca from the Yukon River Association. Well, let me back up. I'm the Bristol Bay manager for Peter Pan Seafoods. I think Rebecca did an excellent job, and I'd just like to echo her comments. In a nutshell, if it ain't broke, you know, why are we trying to change something? While I appreciate the significant modifications that DEC has made over the last 2 years, I still have to oppose them. And I would like to speak out in support, I guess, of HB 328, because I do feel that it closes some small but yet troublesome loopholes. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Mac McLean?
was not intending to testify.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's all we have offline here. So we intend to hear this bill again next Friday at 8:30. So, and we'll take continue to, we'll hear, we have a CS, so what we have in line here, and we'll take testimony at the local level here and any of off-net if we have some. So, yeah, thank you. And thank you for the comparison chart, Mr. Representative Seaton. I think that's very good. So we're adjourned till next Friday.